So to summarize so far, step one of the AI marketer playbook is hyper-personalization at scale. I think step two, which is in a lot of ways is a result of that, is much more automation in the sales versus marketing overlaps and in the operations of getting customers to a sale. I think that's really interesting. Are there any other pillars of this?
Two others. So one multimodal, the next one creators.
This is Unsolicited Feedback with me, Fareed Mosavat, and my co-host, Brian Balfour. Our guest this week is Kieran Flanagan. Kieran Flanagan has been a CMO at companies like Zapier and HubSpot and knows more about B2B marketing than almost anybody else in the world that I know. In this episode, Kieran goes deep on what he calls the new AI marketing playbook. This is a playbook that not only helps you understand how to use AI to improve returns and drive better ROI in your marketing, but also talks about the effects that this may have on the roles and responsibilities of marketers across different parts of the lifecycle. This was a pretty exciting conversation. I loved it. We get into the challenges with Google and many other companies, the problems with SEO, and also his takes on where things are headed. Let's dig right in.
I was working for Zapier. I actually decided to leave. I'm probably going to go back to HubSpot to help them do some things for a little bit. So why am I going back to HubSpot? I want to spend as much time as I can in AI, right? It is a once in a lifetime shift in my lifetime. And even when I've been on paternity leave, like I did this LinkedIn post about potential quote that was attributed to Sam Altman, which is, I would automate 95% of a marketer's time. Now, whether he said that or not, it's a pretty interesting thought exercise. Actually, a really cool thing to do is take a marketing rule and ask Claude to break it up into individual tasks and then say, which of these individual tasks can AI automate in the future? And I'm doing that for an episode of our podcast. And I put that out there and there was like a bunch of LinkedIn comments and people were saying, I think there's three categories of marketers right now, and maybe people in general, but definitely marketers, maybe engineering and things are much different because it's further along, which is stick my head in the sand and hope everything will be okay and just don't use AI. Use AI to do blog posts. And then actually the small collection of people who are like really trying to figure out this AI thing. And what blew me away in the comments is people who say AI is all hype. And I was like, wow, that is mind blowing to me. And so I started working on this 6-day free email course, right? And it's taken foundational lessons from marketing from the 1920s, 30s and 40s, because actually marketing, if you actually go all the way back in time.
Yeah, some of the old school books are the best. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, I think when marketing was the best, when it wasn't a bunch of moving around digits and doing a bunch of iterative work. And
yeah, clicking buttons in the Facebook ad manager.
Yeah. And just, please algorithm A-B test that to me.
Or worse, just writing briefs for other people to do that work, which is the least valuable kind of work in the
that's
world.
That's the whole.
Charge you shit tons of money for it too. Yeah.
Yeah. We can get into the whole, every marketer wants to be a strategist and most of them are awful at strategy. But so I took a timeless lesson, like a lesson from Claude C. Hopkins, who wrote Scientific Advertising, or David Ogilvy, or John Caples, who did the M&M ads, which is one of the best ads of all time. You know, melt in your mouth, not in your hands. Just that incredible strapline. That is great marketing. And then created these advanced prompts to be able to implement them for your brand, and then created a custom GPT to be able to go to the custom GPT and then learn how to do the actual prompt. And I have a newborn, and so I have a weird schedule and I find myself on at 11 p.m. working on this stuff because I love it, right? That's what I just want to do with my time. And so I feel like there is a new go-to-market to be built that's deeply interwoven with AI. And that's what I'm interested to go back and do for HubSpot, because they are willing to take pretty significant risks and take significant bets to do things that are like very forward-thinking.
And to me, it feels like they have to. I was actually going to ask you this before I learned that you were going back to HubSpot, which is... The impressive thing about HubSpot is like since going public, it's just steadily growing between that 40 and 50% year over year. It's just like
long-term compounder.
It's just been a machine.
Day in, day out.
And a huge part of that has just been the consistency of the SEO-driven content machine, which just, it's such a consistent marketing motion in terms of what it delivers and leads and all that kind of stuff over time. And depending on to what extent you feel like SEO is going to be upended, then yes, there's all these consumer UGC SEO kind of driven companies that like we could probably talk about, like which ones are at most risk. But out of the B2B world, HubSpot is most dependent, I think, out of all the B2B companies on a content-driven SEO motion. I was going to ask you about it. I don't even know how much you can talk about it. Now that I know you can go back to it.
I can talk. So I don't know the work they've done in the past 16 months, but I do know that I agree that HubSpot built an incredible content engine with search pretty interwoven into that. The reason we bought The Hustle is because we wanted to diversify our media, right? But we as marketers have been spoiled with search, right? No marketing channel has been better, converts as well, or is as scalable. That's an organic channel, like you leave paid aside. And so there is a reckoning coming for most B2B companies in terms of, you look at search being disrupted by AI chat. The disruption is actually pretty interesting to think about, because the disruption started with Google many years ago, right? The first time they created feature snippets, which is basically, how do I scrape a website and show you the answer on our page so you don't have to visit that page? And way back when they launched that, we did a study in HubSpot. And what it showed was the majority of users thinks that's a better experience. And actually, all of the keywords on that page, when a feature snippet showed, got way less traffic, right? And so you could see this coming from way away, because AI chat is just a self-contained platform that provides you a better answer. And so we started to try to diversify that with The Hustle, with all these different other kind of media. Now, they don't convert as well. They're not as direct or indirect. But the other thing that HubSpot has worked
on, are they as consistent?
They're not as consistent, and they're far harder to predict. But HubSpot does much better today than probably what we needed to do 5 or so years ago to actually qualify and close the demand we got. Well, HubSpot generated so much demand that you didn't really have to optimize all the way through the funnel, because like me and Kip always just cared about expanding the top of the funnel. But they've got really diligent about using AI. I know you had Kip on the show about using AI to better convert the demand that they get. And I think for any B2B company, is you have to maximize much more the demand that you get. And you probably have to interweave outbound a little more, right? I think in a typical B2B company, because I actually don't think there's a like-for-like replacement to search, unless both of you have some ideas on what that might be.
Yeah, so it's not going to be like a smooth deleveraging. No. It's going to be bumpy.
We did have Kip on the show, and one of the interesting conversations we had was, is it possible? There's a big pile of consumer AI companies and B2B AI companies, but most technological inflections that have driven whole new markets have been a combination of technology improvements with new distribution channels. And one of the conversations we had is, if anything, we have the opposite of new distribution channels. We have the shrinking of distribution channels. And one of the points that he made that I thought was a very astute observation was this piece on conversion, which is, yeah, but we can get so good at finding the right people and converting them and nurturing and driving better results, because AI creates basically infinite personalization capabilities, measurement capabilities, decision-making capabilities. I'll pitch something a founder I met the other day and launched that I saw yesterday, which is a set of AI tools for taking your brand creative and turning it into ad creative. Now, if you imagine automation around that, it's someday connected to the Facebook ads platform or the Google ads platform. You can imagine a world where you have the perfect ad for the perfect person in their perfect situation with great creative for every single micro audience. That looks like a new channel in some respects, even though it's a smaller channel that's a different channel. So I think there are opportunities, but I think you're absolutely right that this isn't a new thing. It's just an acceleration of what Yelp was yelling about over a decade ago with Google, which is they're front running our stuff. They like figured out that they were sending a bunch of traffic to us. They put something in front of it, grabbed a bunch of that for themselves, and left us out to pasture. And we're seeing this day in, day out with question boxes, answers, and even stuff pulling away. I've been pretty consistent, and I think this is really bad for Google, because they say, oh, people will go to ChatGPT. I'm starting to come around to, as long as they eventually get the tech right, Google will be fine. It's everybody who relies on Google to grow their business that could have trouble.
I don't think Google will be fine, and I can give you the maybe the reasons against that. You would never have ever had a conversation with a single person in tech where a 250 person company would have created a search engine and you would be like, oh, it's like as good as Google, right? In the same way that we're talking about Perplexity, it could be as good as like Gemini, right? Or the Google Gemini search experience. And I think the reason we're having those conversations is because Google's PageRank algorithm was such an innovation and it dominated the market in such a way that there was just nothing comparable. And I can't remember, I started my career in search. I can't remember ever sitting down with a group of tech people and saying, Bing is comparable to Google or this is comparable to Google. Like, it's just as good. It was just like, use Google, right? I don't think that's happening with the AI chat experience, like Perplexity, or all, there's tons of them, right? There's companies of very small sizes all creating these kind of AI chat experience. And when you start to verticalize it, it gets even messier, right? You have ones for medical, you have one for law. So I don't know how they have the same sort of ownership of that space. I think it gets commoditized and everyone seems the same because the models all seem the same and the models are all being commoditized as well. And the other thing is, they need to monetize still through ads, right? I think Perplexity started with subscription, like it's going to be a subscription service, and now they're trying to integrate ads because I just don't think they're going to make the same type of revenue through a subscription model. Like ad revenue is a far better model for a search, the search space. I don't know, have you used any of these chats and ever really clicked on anything within that chat, right? If you actually look at the data on just like going back to what we've seen happen on Google itself, no-click searches back in 2019, which is like the number of people who would search something on Google and just not click on anything because their answer is within Google, was around like 40 or so percent on desktop. Today, it's 70 plus percent. On wow. mobile, it's 80 plus percent, right? So the majority of people are already telling us, I don't want to click on your links. Just give me the answer, right? And it's a better user experience. And in my, like, I'm not a product builder, like both of you are, but if you build something that is easier and quicker, the easier and quicker always win because humans don't want to do work, right? And I feel like that is the problem that Google have.
Yeah, I agree with that. Look, I use Perplexity a lot. I don't click on any of the links, but what I do is I do scan the links to make yes. a judgment of whether I think yep. this is coming from a reputable source or not.
Exactly.
And so, which is like an interesting behavior, but I guess I'll go back to what something Fareed said and bring this whole thing full circle. I've heard a lot of people comment about AI is bringing the shrinking of channels, and which is probably true. I think it's also bringing a lot of chaos. And in a lot of chaos, I think the best marketers is where they find like the arbitrage opportunities. And it sounds, it brings it to you, Kieran, which is you're feeling that pull. You're like, you're feeling the pull towards the chaos because you're like, there's opportunity.
I do not perform well in a non-chaotic state because I will start creating chaos myself. I've done this throughout my life, which is when I was in search, I was a typical person in search. I owned 100 domains of all the businesses that I would start in search. And anytime I have any, when I'm not feeling fulfilled, I'll go create chaos by starting podcasts and newsletters and all those different things. And so I need the chaotic state to be able to perform. So I feel like this, I agree, like, what I love about this is when people ask what will happen to Google, what will happen to search, like I think it's going to be a slow decline, right? The number of search, the thing I track is the number of searches every single day because Google doesn't release any info on like user data. So it doesn't show any kind of daily active users or monthly active users, but you can look at the number of searches people do each and every day. As long as that doesn't go down, we'll be fine because what you expect to see is AI chat cannibalize that number, right? Because that won't show up in the number of traditional search engine searches. So I think it's a slow decline, but I get asked all the time, how do I diversify away from this happening to me? What is the replacement for search? I was like, I don't know. I love that I don't know, right? Because if I don't know, no one else knows. So there's an opportunity for someone to be to figure that out first. The one thing I'll end on is I do think a pretty good place to diversify away from search, what I would start doing is like YouTube, right? Because I think YouTube actually is a benefactor here because it's video. Yeah. It's far harder to disrupt from AI. It's already the second biggest search engine on the planet. And I love the fact that YouTube is really hard, right? I think it's awesome to focus on the really hard thing if it's applicable to your business and relevant to your business, because the really hard thing is much harder to replicate. And that would be one of the things if I was a business, like if I wanted to try to feel good about diversifying, I would figure out if YouTube is a place that my customers spend time and I could diversify in there.
Interesting. Yeah, we talked about this a bit with Kip around HeyGen and other video creation tools, that it really has not just lowered the barrier to entry to creating video necessarily, these tools, but and the cost, but really that it means you can try things and with a lower clock time.
like iterations are lower. So maybe you can get better at YouTube faster, for instance, than you might be able to otherwise, which I think is a really interesting perspective on
it. Yeah, I love that perspective. I did this like weird pie chart and people really, it's so interesting, tech people. Like I put up this pie chart on LinkedIn before and after, which is before AI, marketers spend 95% of their time using tooling to execute the craft and 5% of the craft. And then the opposite, right? Like with AI, 95% of the craft and 5%. And all the tech people are like, where did you get the data? The pie chart isn't correct. So obsessed with it. Like it's made up, right? It's made up to illustrate a point.
I don't care. I don't know if you remember this or even knew this, but in the very early Signal, what became HubSpot, Sales Hub days, the best performing Facebook ad we had was some kind of pie chart, two pie charts targeted at a salespeople. Percentage numbers were wrong relative to the area of the pie, like obviously wrong. And it was just like a typo that lay in the ad creative. But then the thing performed so well because people were like commenting and all. We couldn't take it off. It was just doing so well.
You invented B2B clickbait.
Oh man, by accident.
Give wrong data. But the point of that chart was exactly what you said, Fareed, which is what I think is really great about AI is we were not meant to spend all of our time trying to implement ideas through tools. Like it's much better to do the work and execute on the work, and the tool should facilitate that in a way where you're not having to get a certificate to use this tool. Like my job is I'm certified to use this piece of software. That is that is so horrible. That's a horrible world to live in.
Yeah.
And so I think AI definitely fixes that, which is the tool should be in the background and you could spend much more time on the iteration and the idea.
Yeah. I think that's going to be a tough adjustment for a lot of folks, though, because I actually think the craft, the energy that the craft requires is a lot more than executing the tool, than clicking the buttons and knowing what buttons to click. And it starts to really expose what you might be good and what you're bad at. And I think a lot of people make careers and good livings out of just knowing the software.
Yeah, I think this is always true, just to be clear, but just I think AI moves it up the stack or accelerates it. It's, are you good at SQL or are you good at understanding how to get answers from data, right? Or get analysis from data? Are you an expert in the vagaries of our specific engineering platform or can you solve new problems using code? Are you really good at using HubSpot or do you know how to make money? you know what I mean? Or whatever it is. It's, are you a Jira expert at like making sure sprints and scrums are like properly organized? Or are you good at getting teams to ship great software? Right. I think if you look at this on every single step, that's always been true. It's what do you guys say about Reforge, Brian? It's application, not certifications. Yeah. I think this is always true. But I think you're right that it's really step function and in certain areas more than others, right? So my question for you, Kieran, what are some of the things you think this AI-powered marketing playbook has more of, less of? Where do the humans fit in? Where does the AI fit in? And what do you think changes about the marketing playbook with this?
Where I started, I'll give you a good example of this as well. Where I started to really play around with AI was, I think, the same place anyone that was really getting into it started as a marketer, which is personalization at scale. And so a good example at Zapier was there's a pretty sizable number of pairings of workflows that you can automate work through. So if you think about a typical like onboarding path, I came in and I looked at all the kind of previous experimentation around how to get people to activate in Zapier, which is like, how do we get people to turn on their very first app and actually automate something? There was like a couple of things that worked, but most things didn't work. And the reason that most things didn't work is because it is really hard to pick the thing that person wants to automate because there's an infinite number of things. And even if you condense it down into the power law and there's like a small subset of apps that take up most of the recipes, it's still like a huge number of pairings. And so the way you would probably solve that is actually write some sort of personalized guide based upon the apps that you have, right? If you can ingest the apps that you had, then you could write like some sort of pretty comprehensive ebook to say, okay, you have these apps. If you're a marketer, here are all the things that you could actually automate, right? As in the jobs to be done, not just like the actual parent of that app. Hmm. But previous to AI, you could never do that, right? Because the unit economics wouldn't work out. Having someone like sit there, oh, someone's logged in and now they have these apps and now I'll write the ebook and send it to them, right? It's not going to work for like a company that's a horizontal and has the amount of users signing up that Zapier does. But wow, AI was really good at it, right? To the point where we really played around with creating these kind of personalized automation books for people who signed up. And there were tended to be larger companies because we were using them as a lead into the sales notion that we were building on top. To the point where we got emails back, I've never seen this before, but people were like, this is the best email I've ever got, because the amount of value and the personalization towards that person was like, I keep forgetting that we live in a bubble and people don't yet know that was done by AI. Now we can get into what happens when everyone does know that it's AI. Do they still feel the same sort of way? But now to them, it's still, it's magical. Wow. Like you knew my app. So I'm a marketer. We have that kind of data. It's pretty standard. But then wow, you wrote something customized for me. That's like all of the ways that I can use your product. That's like kind of mind blowing. The other thing we did within Zapier was the kind of interesting way to break up Zapier is based upon like your familiarity with automation. I started to figure this out in the second half, which is that was actually the most interesting way to segment the business, because the difference between people who did not know automation and the people who were like a career automators, their experience needed to be hugely different, right? But how do you create that in a singular linear path that you normally have? AI is a great way to choose your own journey. So we integrated this idea of an AI concierge. So the AI concierge can navigate you around the product, hold your hand. It could actually build workflows for you. Or if you just said anything in natural language, like how do I get more leads from Facebook into HubSpot? It could actually give you back all the recipes. That was also an interesting way to personalize AI for your needs, because you are basically using it as a always on support rep. So the personalization of scale is like the first one. We'll start where we can get into some others. I would love to ask you both.
Before you go, I'm actually interested in just how you made the personalized ebooks. Did you have like a base template ebook structure, and then you basically just plugged in the apps and the jobs to be done in some kind of like plug and play outline and said, hey, generate something like this, but for X? Or how did that actually work?
Yeah, it's through the prompt. One of the things I've started doing in prompting, I got this from an engineer who's posting a lot about Claude. Now, if I go back to my software developer days, I've started to think of writing my prompts in the same way I would write like HTML code, right? Yeah. So I would have task, step. And I actually, what's really interesting is when you start passing output into variables, so then you can structure the output just asking it to output the variables, like whatever the variables mean. So we created a structure like that, which is like, here's your task, here's the inputs, here's the structure of the general ebook, and here's the output that we need, right? And if you think of the things in variables, if you're a marketer and you have these apps, then this, we taught it how you just speak to jobs to be done. Here's what people find valuable and spit it out this way. Now, the biggest challenge with AI, I'm not sure what you've all found, because I know you've built products for AI and Reforge, but it's like the consistency of output, right? When you put a customer face in, that course that I'm building, I'm sending it to people to say, run the prompts and see what you get. And it's still not consistent, right? There's one that I created. I'll give you a good example. One tip for everyone who wants to prompt and create things that are going to be like content, for example, it could be many things with content, is never take the first output, right? So let's say I say, hey, create me something in the style of Brian Balfour. Give me an incredible point of view around why AI is an explosion for product-led growth. And let's say I have a prompt that can ingest Brian, your writing, and then mimic your style. But what you should then create is a loop, right? And what I do is say, okay, first time go around and then provide yourself edits. Second time go around, integrate those edits, and then give me the fifth one, but show me within a table all the edits that you've made, right? And these are the kind of edits that you're looking for. Now, that is in one of the prompts that I'm going to give away as part of that email course. What I've realized is it will sometimes just not do it. It will just like do it once, and then it will do five times. And I've had the experience where it said, do it yourself.
Yeah.
have you experienced that?
Can you imagine shipping that to a customer? Can you imagine your email?
Why are you telling me to do stuff at 11 p.m.?
And you know what? Yeah. Instead of me telling you how to do this, you should go figure it out yourself.
It literally said, create the thing and provide yourself edits and then integrate the edits. I was like, that is what I'm asking you to do. So it's still incredibly inconsistent.
Have you tried using any of this software to basically build agents? Because one of the techniques in building agents is you essentially, you write different prompts or different roles for creation versus revising, editing, and then approving. And so that basically it's like a team of specialists iterating through that loop. So I'm interested if you've tried any of that stuff.
That is the next thing, to recursive agents that I can pass tasks to. I've spent most of my time building things in custom GPT. Custom GPT is an also interesting thing that we could talk about, because the thing that people didn't talk that much about there, and we can leave that to the next conversation. But I love to think about that as just how you onboard to software, because actually custom GPT has the traditional click panel and then just talk to me panel, which is what we created in Zapier. You can click through things or you can talk to me to onboard you. But all of my work has been in custom GBT. The thing I would say that I figured out in custom GBT is build one where the instructions are over the limit. So it has an 8,000 character limit. So then I figured out the way to build it actually is you can upload 20 PDFs. And so you can have like instructions in each PDF and then just have if then else loops and call the different instructions from that loop, which structures it a lot better. But the thing I really want to get onto is recursive agents that you can actually pass tasks to, because I think it's much better.
Yeah.
Can I just to rewind, since I'm very intrigued at this ebook example, we talked a little bit about how you generate them. Are you doing this on the fly? I visit and type some information in and it is on the fly generated for me? Or is it more like, okay, if we see a lead is in a segment we care about, qualified in a certain way, Kieran or someone like Kieran plugs into all their like fancy Claude or GPT stuff to twiddle around with the prompts and make some output and then be like, hey, this is pretty good. Let me ship it to you.
It's done through Zapier. So you'll hit a certain qualification. The qualification is actually company size and role. And then based on that, you can zap that information over to a Zap. And then the Zap actually has the prompt within it, right? So you ingest that data, you have the prompt, and then you can actually zap back out an email to that person. So it is done on the fly, but there's a time delay, which is actually...
It's better. It makes them feel like it's probably not written.
Yeah,
by AI,
yeah.
Not
they make it feel like there's someone sitting there going like, yeah. Like,
it's,
like
it's not the writer. Fake I'm generating thing that people do where it's just a timer. It's a real thing. Sorry, I just want to dig in a little bit more here. One thing I find interesting about this is that so much of email lifecycle marketing type stuff has really been around, if I send this email, do I get a click through? If I send this email, do I get a lead? Is the conversion rate there? But really here, of course, you can see it in your metrics, et cetera, in some way. But what you're really trying to do is deliver deep customer value, that response you got from a customer, which is, this is the most useful email I've ever gotten. I don't think anybody's ever said that about an onboarding series email that's been sent by a lifecycle marketing team ever, right?
Right.
They tend to be focused around like in an attempt to drive growth metrics, they always tend to be short. They tend to be like big CTA. They tend to have like flashy subject lines. They tend to get filtered into parts of your inbox that never get seen. And what I think is interesting, because you talked about this, so many of the 1920s advertising stuff has resonated with you, is whether we might get back to like marketing being about how this product helps you, how this product solves problems. I love these old long form ads that are all about describing the product because photography was too expensive and like videos didn't exist in print and all these things, instead of just scan this QR code so we can count you as a download on our metric somewhere. And I think that's exciting.
Yeah, the 1920 stuff is relevant again because the 1920 stuff is almost all about the craft because the tools didn't exist back then.
Right.
Right. Exactly. And so, and there were no careers that were just based around the tools. And so that's why I think it's both some of the best timeless and also now most relevant to the next wave. So, yeah.
Yeah. AI has given me a renewed love of marketing, right? You can get very jaded if you're within a career for a certain amount of time. But I feel the same way I did when I first got in because I can play and tinker with things so easily, right? Like creating that email course has been just so cool. And the cool thing about it is every email has a video, it has a homework assignment, all of it. It was all created by AI. Now, I've been telling the AI how to edit things, but I purposely created the course to show what AI can do. I don't care if people find the course valuable or not, but I want to show people how far we've come with the AI, that it crafts the email, comes up with the homework, like all of these different things. I can move so much faster, right? Like you can get so much more done if you know how to use it. And just going into the science and craft, if you actually think of the evolution of marketing, and I was a beneficiary of this because I came into marketing through an engineering background. And so I hit the sweet spot where the data and the science was really becoming very important. And that was a perfect use of the skills that I had acquired through college and the work that I did after college. And I was like, in a sea of marketers, the most technical person, even though when I was a software developer, I was the worst technical person. And so I hit the sweet spot. And over time, what I think happened was marketing managed to get a seat at the revenue table because you could be much more accountable to the work that you did. You could see the revenue, you could do all of the growth and demand and things. But then at a certain point, what's happened is people won't deviate away from the metrics. And so everyone is iterating in their way to like small, tiny little marginal gains. And we're just like tinkering around the edges. And we've forgotten about the kind of craft, the kind of positional work for customers, like really creative things that the ad companies used to do in 20s, 30s, and 40s. And because I feel like where AI is going to excel is much more on the science part, right? I think it's going to be able to automate a bunch of the data stuff, automate a bunch of the experimentation stuff, do a bunch of the tooling for you. You're going to have more time, I think, to get back to the craft. So I think I do think it's an incredible time to be a marketer if that's the thing that you find rewarding.
Let me ask you, as someone who has been building in the space and a lot of the craft you think is what matters, like the further up you go in the stack, the more valuable the human input is. And actually, by removing things in the bottom of the stack, the details, the technical skills, what it does is it helps great craft differentiate. My concern on the marketing side is that there are a lot of people using these tools to dump a lot of low craft shit into channels. And one thing I have learned, Andrew Chen wrote this great blog post a long time ago called The Law of Shitty Click-Throughs.
Yeah.
And the idea is that as a channel goes forward, click-through rates on it decline. Now, I think it's actually more pernicious than that. I think the click-through rate of a channel overall declines with the volume of things that have been sent over it, not the time over it. Does that make sense? And the reason I think this is because at Zynga, we would send things on Facebook channels and they would always improve our metrics. But the more we sent, the worse it got. And so we'd send more and then it would like death spiral down. The more Facebook posts you put out there, the worse the click-through rates got. And I worry, for instance, on outbound, on content marketing, on SEO, the just deluge of low quality stuff is craft enough to differentiate? How do you stand out when other people have flooded with garbage, right? How do I get an email, my highly well-crafted, wonderful ebook that gives amazing instructions on how to really solve a problem stand out from the here's a GIF, SDR, generated AI email that's, dear Fareed, due to your work at Marius, I'd love to, or whatever it is. I worry about that.
Yeah, or the sales reps who have seemed to figure out, or seem to think a great template to send out is like, Kieran, I'm going to remove you from our files if you don't respond to me. Kieran, do you really want me to remove you from files? Remove me from your fucking files. I don't know why I'm in your files to begin with. I don't care.
Does it, if humans were spiraling on this CTR game, is AI just accelerating it, right? If the rational thing to do is send more email at lower click-through rates because you get incremental gain and now I can write a million, how do we save our channels is basically the question I'm asking here.
I think the thing is like marketers saturate old channels and old channels over time decay and plateau. I obsessed about this very question some time back. I was really obsessed about like how AI impacts the best people, right? Because we talked a lot about, I think, just like the standard people and how they use AI, but what does it do to like people who are already credible at their jobs? And there was a great study, I can't recall the university who put it out, who was like broke down that in any kind of like function, there's the lazy worker, the average worker, and the great worker. And I think what you're saying is AI helps the lazy worker do more stuff, right? Like I say, like I'm doing the lazy thing and now I can do way more lazy stuff with AI and I can just saturate all these channels with a bunch of lazy work. And then the average worker, I think that the average worker, some of those average workers maybe make it to the great worker and the great, some of the great workers who use AI do the incredible work, right? And what I mean by that is I still think there's differentiation going to happen that the people who are just really good at things figure out how to use AI to make themselves even better at their work. And it's still going to stand out from the norm, right? So to your kind of example on email, you'll get 100 emails and they're all using the same template because everyone is the lazy marketer and they're copying each other. Then you'll get a couple that are differentiated because they're the average person trying to do it a little bit different, but you don't reply to those. Then you get the one or two that are just like, wow, like that is incredible. That's really relevant to me. I haven't seen something like that before and I respond to that. So I think what changes is you get way more of the crap. And what your point is, does that not saturate all of the channels much quicker? Yeah. Probably, yeah. Right? Like the life of a channel, I do wonder about that, it's so much easier to replicate something. And so like you've always benefited in marketing to being a fast follower and leveraging a channel much faster than anyone else, right? Like Brian taught a whole generation how to leverage growth loops, right? And the people who probably did that at the beginning are much more successful than maybe the people who are doing it now because everyone is doing it, right? And those things plateau over time. Similar, like HubSpot built a great content engine in search and then everyone else tried to catch up. And over time, the benefit erodes. I don't know how that plays out because it comes back to something you said that I did a post on, which is like the number of marketers in the world over the past 5 to 7 years has more than doubled. The number of channels that marketers can market through has actually declined. If you think about most platforms, they become closed wall platforms, right? I use LinkedIn a lot. I have to sneak my link in by doing like the word dot instead of a dot because they actually don't want you adding links, it actually makes the post perform worse. All of these social platforms are closed walled gardens. Look what's happened to Google. Google is following suit, right? It's becoming a closed walled garden where they want to give you the answer without ever giving content publishers any traffic. I don't know how that plays out, if I'm being honest. It is the most complex part, I think, of being a marketer in the next couple of years, in that you have shrinking channels, those channels get saturated much faster, and it doesn't so far look like there is new channels to expand into. Do you believe AI is an benefits PLG companies or the PLG business model more than anything else, because it makes PLG much easier because code becomes much cheaper? But plus, if you were going to do personalization at scale, wouldn't you want the most amount of data you could have to personalize that? And like product data is one of those things. So I was curious to get your
It comes down to the code that's written. Like most PLG companies grow because they somehow leverage some type of viral loop or some type of content. So I think the question to ask is, how does AI affect those loops relative to the other growth mechanisms? And is it better or worse? So, I think at least on the content side of things, right, AI is making content easier to create in these applications and share. On the virality side, I don't know. I got to think about that one for a second.
Let me throw out a slightly different perspective on this. I think PLG has generally worked best in the last era, let's call it the last decade or so, for products that are very horizontal.
Yeah.
Because in order for the product to get virality, which is really word of mouth in the earliest days of it, of their growth, Slack, Notion, Figma, all of these products grew through word of mouth through their target audience in the early days by being 10x better. By being free, they increase the number of people who can talk about that product, and they can convert some small percentage of those. But the market has to be large and horizontal, because you're looking at, okay, for 1,000 people signing up, 300 activate, 10% of those pay. Okay, I've got 100 paid customers. At smallish ACVs, I can generate some growth. Mm-hmm. So one thing I think happens with AI is the code is cheaper to build. And so there are a huge number of smaller markets for whom an enterprise sale makes no sense, because they are actually a lot of HubSpots like types of customers, right? And I'm sure there are many tools that are now cheaper to build that you could build PLG self-service type things, because it's the right fit for the customer. And because it doesn't take 150 people to build it and a huge marketing budget, you could be more targeted and build great, maybe up to $50 to $100 million ARR businesses in those things, without raising a lot of money. So I have that as one. I think there will be a lot of different style PLG companies.
It makes it more economical to build those, but you still have to grow it.
Yes.
You still have to grow it, yeah.
But what, so that's hard, but maybe you can do word of mouth in pocket. So I think you'd have to identify markets where there is high connectivity between the customer base. They're likely to talk about it. It solves a real problem. So I have an equal and opposite view that I'm just thinking through, and I think might be worth debating as well. The other is, channels are dead. They're all saturated. They're all very expensive. AI is just going to make that worse. Okay. The number of people bidding on Facebook ads is going to go up because they can generate, they don't need a creative team to do it. The amount of SEO content, all of that stuff. Let's leave virality out, because I think that's, I'm thinking B2B right now. In that world, the benefit is through personalization. The types of things that make personalization work is, at the end of the day, the end of the funnel, there better be a lot of money, because I've spent so much time and energy hyper-personalizing to get to the right customer. So my instinct would be, okay, actually, PLG's dead.
What ACV I want needs is, to go up.
Yeah, ACV needs to go up. I need to be able to use my very small limited channels to convert people at really high ACVs. So the best business fits will be those. I can see either of those happening, and I suspect the world will be a mix. Does that make sense? But I think the era of like really horizontal, large scale, Slack, Notion, Figma, et cetera, type tools might be harder to come by right now.
Yeah, I guess my question or point is, to your horizontal point, the part of those that work, you walked through the math of one of those growth loops, right? And you have to be horizontal. You have to have a huge TAM for that math to work. And so even in the world where the code becomes cheaper, right? So yes, you can economically build a tool that could be adopted by somebody like in one of those niche markets. It doesn't change the math of those growth loops, right?
It probably can't be like regular freemium, free forever type freemium for sure.
Yeah.
I know like the reason to do PLG is freemium and expand the top of the funnel. But what if you think of the PLG as turning your business into a touchless experience?
Yeah.
And so I think you've probably both seen have you seen the Hume.ai demo where you have the, oh, it's incredible. Like, it's one of those demos where you're just like,
can you just spell Hume for our listeners so they know how to look for it themselves?
It's Hume.ai. Let me just make sure that I've got that right. Yeah. So just the demo is incredible, right? First of all, it's one of the best demos that any software company has put out there because you can literally just go open the chat panel and start having a conversation with this AI. Now, the AI sounds like a person, right? Like, it has all of the emotional cues, can represent them incredibly well, can have a conversation with you. But the other thing it does to pay attention to is it will start to navigate you around the website based upon what questions you have to show you the relevant part on the website, right? So what it's basically doing is a demo, right? It's doing a demo in the same way a sales rep is doing a demo. And so the thing I've been thinking through is there's an explosion of PLG in that companies who could never have had a touchless experience can now actually probably have like their pro completely touchless. One of the light bulbs for me in AI was 18 months ago when I first saw the demo from Adept. I think they're the Google DeepMind crew. They haven't really shipped much, but they were the ones who showed a natural language interface on top of software. And then you could just like talk to the software and it would navigate around stuff in Salesforce, do all the stuff in the different software. And now if you fast forward to today, that technology will allow something like Hume to do an incredible demo of your software personalized to you with the complete questions that you have. And so like how many companies have SKUs that could be sold through that experience that are today sold through a sales rep? And so you actually have way more companies be touchless.
So I like this perspective because if you think about it, product-led growth is not a monolith. It's really for each step of the funnel, are you product-led, sales-led, sales-assisted, or product-assisted? There's a bunch of continuums. But one of the core ingredients of a great self-serve business is low setup cost. It absolutely has. You cannot build a great PLG type business if the activation energy to get to first value is not low. And so there are huge, Snowflake is a great example. It's just too much work. There's no world that you can get to where like building a data warehouse is going to be low setup costs in a traditional style. So I think if I'm just going to recast this back to you, what you're saying is maybe the sets of software for whom the criteria low setup cost or low activation energy is actually much, much higher because of personalized, automated, AI-driven support type systems that would normally be done by an SDR call, a solutions call, a setup implementation specialist, et cetera. I think that's an interesting perspective I haven't thought of.
And it probably doesn't affect like the very small business, which is always already self-serving. It doesn't affect the enterprise. It probably affects like the middle. People in the middle the most, which funny enough goes back to HubSpot. But yeah, but like
Karen, it helps HubSpot.
I think people want to talk to humans for two main reasons. One is personalization. And the second is honestly, I think people are just lazy. Right. Like the info that they're looking for is probably on the website, like somewhere, right? Or in the support docs. It's probably a search away. But they want it like customized and like personalized to them. So if you can accomplish the same things, then like maybe you can shift some of the human touch to AI self-serve.
That product is the first time I felt like that is within like reason, maybe 12 to 24 months, where you can have an avatar with a very emotional kind of voice. But then I connected the dots that you will definitely be able to navigate software and set up software through natural language, because I know you're both active in the startup space. I've invested in startups who are building widgets for software companies that you can just add in and do everything through the AI chat and never have to use the software. But it's like within the software, but it's doing things within the software for you. Mm-hmm. But if you like integrate that into the Hume example, then you can just say, go set up this and do this and show me how it does this. And you're getting a very like personalized experience. And then you can have all the questions that you have answered. I do think it can't do like higher deals. You're looking for discounts. You're looking for all these kind of nuanced things that it can't really replicate. But it does make me wonder, it increases the amount of software that can be sold without humans having to be involved.
Okay, so we did it again. AI marketing playbook.
Ben's going to love editing this episode. Here.
No, look. This is unsolicited feedback. This is how we roll. It's okay. Are there other pillars of it?
This is actually part of it. So I think this is an interesting part, which is who does this work? right? That's an interesting thing to think through, which is typically in an organization, the automators are the marketers, but the marketers hand off to the SDR, then the SDR has to hand off to someone else, the account manager or the account rep. And then when you become a customer, they hand off to the onboarding specialist. And when they become onboarded, they hand off to the account manager, right? And like that experience in a lot of companies is really bad because you're handing off to different orgs and they all have their different way of doing things and you ship your org design, right? Everyone, I think that's been talked about ad nauseum in tech. What is pretty interesting here is for that messy middle that maybe can start to do a bunch of this through AI is there you can create a singular experience with no handover, right? It's the same person mm-hmm. walking you through the entirety of the experience all of the time. And I think marketers probably do much more of that work than other teams because marketers are the automators in most companies, right? And so I do wonder if we see marketing own more of the customer journey and start to integrate the SDR function, integrate yeah. customer support, integrate parts of that. That's what I believe, right? That's what I want to happen.
Super interesting.
And that's what you yeah. want so to
like,
happen.
So, but then I mean, the question sort of is, it smells like growth. It smells like growth from the early from the first decade of the 2000s, right? Why did growth teams exist? Growth teams came about for very similar reasons. Data was more important. More work was going towards engineering, who were the automators at that time. Just to be clear, there weren't automation was not done in marketing right. in 2005 or whatever. Right. People had to develop a new sort of set of criteria for what it meant to drive growth in an organization. That was one, more of the product is driving growth through things like virality, content and SEO, et cetera. And second, the engineering piece of the puzzle. And I think what you're describing is a very similar
right.
type of move around how sales is done, if I'm reading what you're saying right, which is, hey, this idea that there's like sales and marketing is handing leads off to them or whatever it is, like automation, but sales is doing the real work of closing the deals. That line is blurrier. It's starting to look a lot like it's not someone markets it and someone sells it. It's one closed loop funnel with a lot of more automation opportunity. I think that's right. an interesting perspective. Maybe we'll see more CROs who are marketers instead of sales leaders.
Exactly.
I think the marketing sales relationship is trickier than the marketing product relationship because the moment you touch the sales incentives and compensation, which some of the things you're talking about, Kieran, would eat into yeah. some of the easiest sales, right? And that was always the struggle between product growth in PLG-driven SaaS products, product teams, and sales-assisted teams. Yeah.
It allows sales to work in better qualified deals, and you are able to increase their quotas. Because maybe they shouldn't be working on that.
They right? shouldn't. Like, we all know that they shouldn't. Yeah, but that's not how it works.
This is the trend we saw in PLG, just to be clear. Like, some of the biggest benefits we created as a growth team for the sales team at Slack was pulling them out of doing manual assist on low ACV deals. They all made more money, not less money, by saying support's going to handle companies under 100 employees. You're never going to touch them. And at first, it was a little scary because it's, but like I'd sell some of those and some of them turn out to be 200 employees or whatever it is. But what happens is, you get a smaller number of things that you have a higher likelihood to close, et cetera. One thing we talked about with Aaron White a lot was AI creates the opportunities to automate things and have humans as exception handlers, not as the primary loop. We talked about it with support. It's I can handle most of the support requests, but I get confused and it pops out to a human. The human solves the exception. And then the next time, hopefully the AI can do that same thing.
Yeah, you
again,
engineer that back
fewer
in.
And fewer.
Exactly.
And I think that's what sales type things end up looking like too.
The other part of that, just to round out that conversation, is AI procurement agents. That's the other thing I've been thinking through because I don't think a single person wakes up and goes, you know what I want to do for this week? I want to buy software.
I want to not buy software. I want to negotiate software other people in my company want to buy.
Right. This is the thing I want to spend my time on. I want to go research a bunch of websites and create a comparison table to figure out like what is the best piece of software that I need to buy. And like when you think about an agent, you can program an agent to go do that work for you, right? I can program an agent to go consume everyone's email flows, to create synthesize those emails, to go in and create a demo. And probably at some point, because we're going multimodal, I think GPT-5 will be a huge step up in multimodal, probably be able to demo software, record that software and come back with customized demos and fill out a checklist of here's the stuff that hits the checklist, here's the stuff that doesn't hit the checklist. I think of it like maybe a mini kind of G2 experience, like just customize and build for myself. And in that place, it's wacky to think that my go-to-market has to think about how LLMs consume the knowledge I put out during that customer experience, right? Like, how do I create a customer experience that actually is good for the agents and good for the humans?
Yeah, the AI procurement is, it feels like the next gen G2 crowd, right? Like, rather than trying to sift through all of these reviews that I know were incentivized by the company anyways, right? To get to the truth.
So to summarize so far, step one of the AI marketer playbook is hyper-personalization at scale. I think step two, which is in a lot of ways is a result of that, is much more automation in the sales versus marketing overlaps and in the operations of getting customers to a sale. I think that's really interesting. Are there any other pillars of this?
Two others. So one, multimodal, the next one, creators. So I think multimodal is the thing that I have thought most about this year. Multimodal is when we can actually have video, audio, and text as like inputs and outputs to AI, and it works really well. And we've seen OpenAI come out with Sora. We saw Google come out with Vlogger. I know Microsoft, I don't know how these companies are doing it. Like, they all seem to be like in pretty good lockstep of releasing their technology at the same time. So we're seeing, I said at the start of the year, one of the predictions we did in our podcast was, I thought this was the year of AI video, right? We would see leap forwards in terms of our ability to create video. And we're not there yet, right? I've used HeyGen a lot and it's still pretty like emotionless, right? When you create a video, but these other tools I think are going to unleash. There's a huge amount of marketers who have incredible ideas for videos, but are held back because they don't have the skill sets to create the video, have to go to the agency, have to do these kind of things.
And worse, the iteration speed is too low. You talked about that loop with GPT. Give me feedback, give me approval, figure out how to make it better. There's no iteration in video. It's one and done. It's really hard. Yeah.
So I think we're going to see the marketing playbook evolve to be much more multimodal, right? Less text, more video, more audio. And I think it's a great time to actually start to do this, right? That's one of the bets we made at HubSpot was we bought The Hustle, built the media network, grew out a multimodal kind of experience. At Zapier, one of the first hires I made was someone who was incredible at YouTube because I believe, again, that I would diversify into YouTube. And actually, that's a great platform for Zapier. I believe it's underutilized and they'll do incredible stuff there. So I think multimodal, if I was a marketer looking at my strategy, I would want to start to diversify in these other mediums and start to play around with these tools to see if I can use any of them to start to create these kind of multimodal experience and audio as well. I don't know what your experience is, but I have to stack rank on things to like easy to grow, hardest to grow. Audio is actually the hardest to grow. And again, I think it's sometimes best to do the hard thing because the hard
thing is hard. That's my experience.
the hard thing is hard.
Should we insert here? Just recommend this podcast to a friend. Please help our word of mouth loop. Yeah.
Please recommend and please send me feedback. I'm always down to hear what you guys want to hear on and how to make this better. Because that's
right. So I'm multimodal. The other one that I've talked a lot about is the creator part, right? When you think about that conversation we had on there's channels, the decrease in channels for marketers, but the ones that are thriving are better for individuals and brands, right?
Yes.
YouTube, TikTok, all these different channels are better for individuals and brands. So what do brands actually do? They get crowded out of those channels. Plus brands suck at creating content for the most part because they have to sit in the middle and be vanilla and can't say anything that actually upsets anyone. But hopefully we're getting away from that a little bit. But that's where we've been as a tech, right? But creators don't have that problem. That's why you see creators crush everyone in these channels because they can have point of views, they can entertain, they can be humor. And I think that we're going to start to see brands need to integrate creators into the marketing strategy. Like at HubSpot, we launched a creator program. I'm actually in the creator program now since I was at a HubSpot as part of that. Launched it and then became part of it. People who are seasoned creators are just much better at creating content because that's the thing they do day in and day out. They figure out, how do I get people to care about the stuff that I create? And so I do think we're going to start to see B2B brands do deals to make creators part of the team. And I think it's just part of like how you do creative deal making. That's what we had to do at HubSpot to get creators to work with us. Like, there's just how do you create creative deals. They're not like, come work for us for the standard like way that every other person works for us. There's a different way that you're going to have to attach them to your brand. I think we see B2B creators become a bigger thing. I invested in a company recently that's a platform for B2B creators because what I see happening in the Reforge cohort, I don't know what you've seen, but there's more and more of the network that I'm part of. And I saw it in some of Reforge, the best people in Reforge, they want to go and create content. They want to go and create and have an audience of your own.
Yeah, I think it's more wanting to have an audience versus a desire to create. Yeah, yeah.
Because audience is currency. It's the most valuable 100%. Currency you can have online, and you can trade it for a bunch of things. And I think as we start to see these other traditional channels, like performance marketing channels, become disrupted, there's going to be more openings for brands within the B2B space to work with B2B creators, and they'll probably value the size of their audience much higher than they do today. So there's a way for B2B creators then to make more money and it become part of like how they actually make money. So they're the two other things I think that AI does, is it basically forces you to be much more multimodal, and multimodal is really hard. Video is way harder than text. Audio is way harder than video. And it actually forces you to either figure out how to have creators be part of your team or do partnerships with creators to make them part of your marketing strategy.
Mm. Yeah. I think the people follow people trend has been happening for years. And we talked about this inside Reforge years ago. And then I think the algorithms on all the platforms have just played into it, essentially, and amplified the whole thing. I think the other thing is the best creators don't want to work for a company full time. So you can't even hire the best creators.
It's got to be a different model. So the old model was creator is a hidden person and tweets as the social media presence of a brand. I run the HubSpot account or whatever it is. And I think what you're saying is there's going to have to be a new model where it's, and I think this is a great opportunity for a segue actually here, which I'll do in just a second. I am me, but I am talking about the brand, or not even talking about the brand. I am just connected with the brand in some way. I think that's super interesting because you can't have all your brand guidelines extinguishing their personality all the time.
See, there's a couple of important things. First of all, you need to be a brand that is not going to chop out the creativity. And some brands just, that's not them, right? And so if you're, that's not you, don't try to work with creators because they either will not want to work for you, or then they will work for you because the money's really good, but you'll stifle their creativity and you might as well just get someone internally to do that. The second thing is the way we set up the creator program at HubSpot was much more like a VC company than a traditional, here's the flat fee. It's basically that we give creators the opportunity to grow within the network. And the more your platform grows within the network, you go through this kind of DC, B, and A, and you get paid differently each time you get into one of those cohorts. It's like creative deal making, right? Like you can't think of it as a traditional employee or a traditional partnership.
Mm. Hope you enjoyed this part one with Karen Flanagan. We'll be back with part two in just a few days, where we dig into the latest AI hardware devices, Humane and Limitless, and compare and contrast the approaches in their marketing and product strategy.